5, 6, and 7. I want to remind you.
Thank you, Brian. We're good to go. Okay. I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not keep their proper domain had left their own abode, as he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. So we have three examples, okay, right off the bat. Again, he's use of three. Let's get a different color if we can. Okay, so the first one is the story of the spies. Second one is the issue with the angels. And the third one is Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. And so we have these stories, and you'll remember them. And then the interesting thing is then in the very next verse, and I want to change my thinking a little bit, or tell you of my change in thinking. I really think verse 8 should not be a new paragraph. Do you all have a new paragraph in verse 8 in your translations? Okay, some do, some don't. Remember that when Jude wrote, he didn't write in paragraphs. Okay, with the idea that we have paragraphs, units of thought, things like that. Okay, he didn't do that. But rather, one long continuous text and later on as they wrote them, they're called uncials. Uncials mean they are all capital letters with no spaces between words, so many characters per line, typically something like 40 characters per line. And wherever the 40th character was, that's when the line ended and the next one started. And you didn't care if it was the middle of the word or anything, nothing but a hyphen, none of that. No periods at ends of sentences, no capital letters, lowercase letters, because they were all capital letters. And before that, they had everything that was all lowercase. Okay, so, and finally, later on, the rules of punctuation and grammar and capitalization were developed, like we have. But I think verse 8 really belongs at the end of this because it's sort of a summary of the points here. And you see, as we were looking at, likewise also these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries. And so we have them, and I think we get the hint here. Why does Jude pick these three stories? And the answer is, as he tells in verse 8, he talks about these dreamers, probably a reference to the people claiming some sort of dreams from God, direct revelation. These dreamers are just like these people, and we see that they're actually in reverse order. So what are they, those three items? So the dreamers do what? What's the first one? Okay, defile the flesh. That's definitely Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Okay, the next one, reject authority. Definitely the story with the angels because they didn't keep their proper domain. Okay, and then what's the next one? And this is a translation issue because some of you may have different translations. Okay, what is the last one? Blaspheme the glorious ones. Now, that's a very good translation because the Greek term there is blaspheme, and we're going to see it's used a few more times. So they blaspheme. They speak disrespectfully of the glorious one. So they blaspheme the glorious ones. You glorious ones. The Greek term here is the doxos, D-O-X-O-S. We've seen that word as a glory, like doxology. Okay, so we've seen that. So they blaspheme the glorious ones. And we saw, what is the story really here? Is that the people didn't trust God, and part of that lack of trusting God, remember, it wasn't a story of disobedience, it was primarily a story of lack of trust, and therefore they disobeyed. So what did they say when the spies came back? You remember at the end, Joshua says, look it, God's with us, and if God's with us, we'll go ahead and we'll win. And what is the people's reaction? Let's throw out Moses and Joshua and Caleb and all these guys, and let's get a new set of leaders that are going to take us back to Egypt. See? So they blaspheme the glorious ones, the leaders that they had there. Okay? So that's why I think that verse 8 is really a summary of what Jude's been doing with these stories and how it relates to the whole point. Otherwise, they're just interesting little stories. And we asked the question, well, why is Jude talking about these? What's his purpose with these stories? And the answer is that he's telling us these people with dreamers do these things, these dreamers. And I think that the kind of thing that was going on there in the churches that Jude was dealing with. Now, a couple of points also related is a sort of a review. You remember that when we talked about the word example in verse 7, Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, in a similar manner, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example. And we asked the question, how are we supposed to deal with the Old Testament stories? And we looked at the different words, and they're in your notes at the top of page 9, the third, fourth line. Compare the terms degma, hupodegma, and tupos. Okay, and are we ever supposed to look at the Old Testament stories as examples as well as types? And the answer, of course, is yes. And we saw how even in the passage in 1 Corinthians 10, some people, here's the point. Let me be a little clearer. Some people want to look at 1 Corinthians 10 and they say, look, it, you are never to get examples out of the Old Testament. It's all typology. And we saw that not only does that not fit what we have in Jude here is as well as the other uses of hupodegma, but also even in 1 Corinthians 10, 6 and 11, we see that the author there is saying these things are examples to us. Now, they may be examples of what not to do, rather than examples of what to do, but they're still examples. Now, given that, I wanted to talk a little bit about this. Did y'all get the New Horizons? Ours just came yesterday. Okay, I don't know if you got them in the last day or two. This is on the Church and Singles. There's really a very interesting little article by Larry and Gail Menninger right here, Parental Dating Guidance. Do y'all know Larry Menninger? Now, who's Larry Menninger, right? He's a pastor of the church in Orlando, okay? And he's been at that church since he graduated from seminary, okay? He graduated from seminary before I did, okay? He was there. He was a year or two ahead of me, and he was actually getting his master's, his second master's there. So Larry Menninger is a very interesting guy. He and his wife, just wonderful people. And he wants to talk about the whole issue of parental guidance. Now, he and his wife, Larry and Gail, have this little story at the beginning, of course, of what we're not supposed to do and how we use Scripture. So I want to read this to you because this is how some people use the Old Testament. And Larry and Gail are trying to say, of course, let's not do this. Don't worry about finding a wife, son. I'll send our servant to my hometown. When he finds a girl who will draw water for him and the camels, he'll give her some jewelry, talk to her parents, and bring her home to your tent. It's all in the Bible. A perfect plan. Now, what story is that talking about? Right, Rebecca and Isaac. That the servant went there and how to get a wife for Isaac, right? Now, seriously, do not people do that and say, well, that's how we're supposed to use the Bible? And they get those kinds of principles. Now, they might say, drawing water for the camels, that's a little bit tough these days, you know? Fill the radiator in my car or something if it's low. I don't know. But seriously, people misuse the Bible like this. Now, notice the very next sentence. So if you haven't read this article, go read it. It's a very good little article. Well, most Christians realize that Abraham's strategy for locating Isaac's wife does not constitute a command for us today. Now, do you get the point? Does not constitute a command for us today. Some people look at historical events and try to draw commands out for us. Bad hermeneutic. And that's, of course, Larry and Gail's point here is that it's a bad hermeneutic. So, and I wanted to do that because in page 9, the very next question in the study sheets, how have people misused Old Testament examples? We've talked about David and Goliath, Gideon and the fleece, okay, and here's another one, okay, with Larry and Gail using that one to tell us how not to use the Bible. So that's where we are. Any questions on the review? Okay, don't see any. Well, let's go on. bottom of page 2. We have these warnings here. We've seen the one where there is the review there in verse 8. Now let's look at verse 9. Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke you, but these speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them! For they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." Now, this story about Michael and the archangel arguing with the devil over the body of Moses, where's that in the Old Testament? You mean it's not in it? But he's just telling us about Michael the archangel. Isn't Michael the archangel in the Old Testament? Is Michael the archangel in the Old Testament? Kind of maybe. If you get your concordance and look at the word Michael, it's a pretty common name. And everybody that it talks about Michael is somebody we know nothing about other than Michael was this or Michael was that. And that's about, you know, part of a sentence. Okay, except for a couple times in the book of Daniel, there's an angel named or a messenger named Michael. Okay, and there's, your references are there. So let's turn to Daniel 13. Okay. So if you're unsure where the book of Daniel is, come to evening church and you'll find out. What? No, chapter 10, I'm sorry, verse 13. I said that wrong. Thank you, Robin. Chapter 10, 13.
New chapter in the Bible there.
Yeah, we're adding new chapters in the Bible, right? Dreamers, huh?
Must have been direct revelation this morning.
It must have been, yes. I'm going for more coffee. Didn't have enough salsa on my eggs or something. I don't know. Or too much. Okay. So, the book of Daniel occupies an interesting place in our English Bibles. Why? Where is it? It's right after the major prophets and just before the minor prophets. Right? So, okay, so was Daniel a prophet? The Jews do not consider him a prophet. Isn't that interesting? The Jews divide the Old Testament into three parts. The Torah, the Ketuvim, Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, okay? The law, the prophets, and the writings. The writings include Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the book of Daniel, among others. Now, why do they not consider Daniel a prophet? Well, think of whom did Daniel minister to? Was it to the people of God, to the Jews? No, he was a high-level government bureaucrat for a pagan, well, king or kings, right? And they say, you go back to Deuteronomy 13 and 18 and what the prophets were like, Daniel doesn't meet that definition, that criteria. So they put the writing of Daniel somewhere else. Interesting. So I think it's an interesting place that we put sort of as a transition between the major prophets and the minor prophets. Just a little side note there. But let's go to Daniel chapter 10. So there's this glorious man. So it says in verse 1, in the third year, Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was delivered to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food. No meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all until 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. Now, on the 24th day of the first month, as I was beside the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Uphaz, whose body was like beryl, his face was the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. Therefore I was left alone, and when I saw this great vision and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was turned to frailty in me, and I retained no strength. Yet I heard the sound of his words, while I heard the sound of his words, I was in a deep sleep on my face, with my face on the ground. Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking these words to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, Do not fear, Daniel, for behold, the first day that you said in your heart to understand, to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So there's the name Michael, one of the chief princes. People think that that means he was one of the archangels, probably. That's the idea. Hi. Okay. Now, if you turn over or go down to verse 21, let's go to verse 20. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one that holds me except these, except Michael, your prince. We're not getting a whole lot of help here, are we? Okay, but they think again that he's one of the archangels. Then if we go over to chapter 12, verse 1. At that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, and it goes on. So we're not getting a lot of background, a lot of help, other than this Michael is a leader, apparently, of the army of God in some way, because he talks about battling with the prince of Persia. Then if we go to Revelation chapter 12, okay, and this is the passage the pastor preached on a few weeks ago at Christmas Eve, and there's a war in verse 7 of Revelation 12, okay? A war breaks out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, and they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who perceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So there's Michael and his angels. Okay. We've just looked at some total passages where Michael, possibly an archangel, is referred to. So we don't have a whole lot of knowledge, a whole lot of help with that. There is a reference in 1 Thessalonians 4:16. Do you all know what that one is? Michael's not mentioned, but the name archangel is mentioned. The Lord shall come with the shout of the archangel and with the trumpet. Okay, talking about the second coming of the Lord. I always want to say the trumpet of the archangel, but that's not right. That's not what it says. It's the shout of the archangel. Now, do you understand what the word archangel means? Arche in Greek means chief or leader. Like, can you think of anything like that? The high priest, the Greek term is the word arch and priest. Archbishop is the leading bishop, right? Okay, something like that. So that's what the term means. So let's get back to Jude and see what this is telling us. Michael the archangel in contending with the devil. Well, we've seen some references to contending with the prince of Persia or the devil, you know, like in Revelation 12. But this is talking about a historical event before when he disputed about the body of Moses. Now, when did Michael the archangel and the devil fight over or dispute, have an argument about the body of Moses? A long time ago. The answer is, we don't know. Okay? This reference is to a reference from an apocryphal book that tells a story. Now, let's go back to Deuteronomy 24 and look at the death of Moses. Or Deuteronomy 34, I'm sorry. Deuteronomy 34 and look at the death of Moses. And then there is some reference to the story of... Diane, can you get Kistemacher out? Thank you. In Kistemacher, there's a statement about it. We might be able to read it to you. So Deuteronomy 34, this is the death of Moses. First question, before we read it, Who wrote the book of Deuteronomy? Then how could he talk about his death and burial? Exactly. There's a couple different answers. One is that Joshua went up the mountain with him, and that Joshua wrote these down and added it to the end of the book of Deuteronomy. Another one is that another prophet got the story, the Lord revealed this to him, and he wrote it, and it was added at the end of Deuteronomy. Another answer is the Lord revealed this to Moses ahead of time, and Moses wrote it before his death. Okay? But this is an interesting argument. We can't pretend this is not there, because the liberals like to use this to disprove the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch and the book of Deuteronomy. Okay? So we have to remember this passage is in the book of Deuteronomy. The question is, who wrote it? And the answer is, we're not sure. So verse 34, or chapter 34, verse 1. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo on the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. So you remember where this is, right? We have our... goes like that. This is Mount Carmel. We have, actually, right about here. And then we have, down here is the Dead Sea. So it's somewhere over here. Right? Remember, Jerusalem is right about there. Jericho is right about here. So it's somewhere over here on this mountain. So it's east of Jordan. The Lord takes Moses up here, and the Lord gives Moses a vision of this whole land. Now, it's farther than a human can see, because he sees all the way out to the Mediterranean. We'll read that and see that. Okay, so, but the Lord gives Moses this vision of the land, so you're going to see the land, but you're not going to enter into it. Okay. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea in the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, this is the land I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over from there. Now, what did he see? What are the places that are mentioned there? Can somebody read some of those to me? Okay, so that's Judah. Now that's over in here, right? This is Judah, where the tribe of Judah was. What else? Zoar. Where's Zoar? Lot with Sodom and Gomorrah. Yeah, Sodom and Gomorrah. Where was Sodom and Gomorrah? Right down in here, we think. Okay? Just on the edge of the Dead Sea, in that area, we think. And you remember that not only was Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed, but the cities in the area, the suburbs, but Zoar was the one that was not destroyed. That's the one where Lot went to. The Lord did not destroy Zoar.